Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. Here's another one from our trip to Dingle County, Kerry last month for Other Voices. Ona Brennan is a name you'll be hearing a lot from in the coming months. Currently a Sinn Féin councillor on South Dublin County Council, Ona is also a key party strategist. Ahead of the 2016 general election, Ona joined us to talk at length about the rise of Sinn Féin as a political force, the party's strengths and weaknesses, the Irish-less political fortunes, the changing nature of Irish activism, his insights about what comes next for the party, the IRA Army Council and Gerry Adams' tweets. Everybody, welcome back here to Banter in Foxy John's. Good afternoon, welcome back. Bit of hush, please, a bit of hush. Lovely, excellent, thank you all very much. Good shout on. But right now we are joined by an author, a politician, a candidate in the forthcoming general election, whatever that will be, a councillor on South Dublin County Council, and a member of Sinn Féin's strategy committee. Would you please welcome Ona Brennan?
Thank you very much. Jim.
I left out one line in that one, Owen.
Yeah, and I'm sure
that
you
was,
did.
Yeah, I left out many lines. But like the one I left out was kind of former bass player in a rock and roll band. My first encounter with you was, this is going to sound really, really dodgy, especially on the podcast. My first encounter with you was as a schoolboy. You were the schoolboy. It's true. You were in a band called The Foreman. Tell us about that band.
I'm kind of reluctant to do it because you have that kind of Tony Blair moment where you try and be kind of cool and pretend you're a guitar player and embarrass yourself. I was in a school band. I don't think there's much more to it than that.
More than a school band.
School band who were okay.
School band did quite
well. Some journalists,
for
some aspiring journalists at the time thought we were better than okay, but we were just okay.
You ended up playing with supporting Rory Gallagher.
We did.
Okay, who else in the band?
There were four of us. There was a drummer, Gavin.
Hence the name.
There was Simon Crosby, rhythm guitar player and singer, and a guy called John McCann.
Okay. Well, did any of them stay in music?
I don't think so. I think they all play. I don't play anymore, but they all still play music in some shape or form.
Okay, so after like being decided that rock and roll wasn't for you, you headed off to London, and you studied in London, didn't you?
Yeah, I'd kind of left school without any qualifications, so I moved to London, went back to school, did A-levels, worked, went to college, did a degree, and then came home.
Okay.
So yeah, and got kind of involved in politics more in London first than here.
Okay, what degree did you do over there? What college did you do in?
East London Polytechnic, cultural studies, history, politics, literature, political theory, those kind of things.
Why did you go to London?
It's funny, Dublin in the end of the 80s, like you often hear people kind of complain about Dublin in the 80s as a very drab city. It was probably actually a really one of the most exciting times, certainly from my memory of it. And particularly that kind of 87, 88, 89. So I really liked Dublin. So it wasn't that I was fleeing the city or didn't like it. I just didn't have anything else particular to do. If I stayed, I probably would have continued with music. But it wasn't what I was interested in. And London was the closest big city to us. So.
Okay, so like, I mean, while you were doing that, while you were kind of like studying for the degree at the East London University, I mean, was it that stage that you kind of like, I suppose, got more involved in politics? Well, like, was there politics in your family? I'm curious about this, because your sister Sinead is also kind of like Sinn Féin activist.
She is, yeah, and she was formerly in the Green Party. There was no politics in the family when we were growing up, or no obvious politics. Although, interestingly, subsequently I found out my grandfather was a very active member of Clan na Publaigh and the Workers' Party. He would have known Brendan Behan personally very well and Sean McBride, and would have gone to meetings in Mud Gone McBride's house when she was quite old. But as we were kids, no, there was no politics of any discernible kind. Living in London was kind of interesting because at the end of the 80s, the one thing that you didn't hear anything about in Dublin was the North. So people talk politics, people talked international politics, but it was almost like just that line at the border, just kind of everything stopped. And of course, when I went to London, that changed. So I worked full-time all the way through school and college, and I would have worked with a lot of folks from the North, different political backgrounds, community backgrounds. You would have read a lot more about the North in the newspapers, no matter what newspapers. And I worked in Soho in the centre of London during the tail end of the IRA's bombing campaign. Again, this was before I was involved in politics. So all of that was kind of there and was around. And then when I was in college, I got very involved with the National Union of Students, with the anti-racism campaigns, with the Irish Student Society in East London, and also with my trade union, the caterers trade union at the time. So all of those things kind of
Right. So being classic left-wing apprenticeship. So when you came back to Dublin, then you joined Sinn Féin. Why did you join Sinn Féin?
I came back to Ireland to do that. That was kind of the plan, really. And again, I suppose the context is important. You're talking about 1995, ceasefire in August 94. Things had been moving in a very interesting direction. So for, I suppose, anybody like me who was becoming more republicanised, it just seemed a logical thing to do, that if you thought what was happening was good, then roll up your sleeves and get involved. So I came out to Dublin, stayed here for three months, and then moved to Belfast and started working full time for the party.
Okay, so let's go to Belfast thing in a minute. I'm curious about what you said about like becoming more Republican. You know, I mean, was there any particular one incident, or was it a kind of like a case of seeing what Sinn Féin was doing on the ground? I mean, it's like I'm kind of looking at the apprenticeship you had, like what the parties you were joining. I mean, I'm thinking about mid 90s. I mean, Labour wasn't completely fucked at that stage. You know, you could have went you could have went that way. There's an alphabet soup of trots out in the far left.
Sure.
Why was it Sinn Féin?
Well, keep in mind, I was politicised in London rather than in Dublin initially, so that plays part of it. I think for a lot of, I suppose, people of my background, when you moved to London, you did one of two things. You either escaped from being Irish and you kind of immersed yourself in this cosmopolitan metropolis, and for some of the people I went to school with and I met in London, they were almost embarrassed to be Irish at that stage. And then I suppose my experience was just about, not that I thought being Irish was better than being anything else, but you got a sense of what it actually meant to be Irish alongside all of these people from these other parts of the world, including England. So I became much more aware of my Irishness. That was a really important thing. And then because the conflict was around, because you were meeting people who had fled from it or had been involved in it or had views on it, and because of the very early stages of the peace process, there were openings and opportunities there for good things to happen. I just became interested and had lots of questions. And so it wasn't necessarily because of knowledge of individual Sinn Féin politicians or activists or what they were doing. It was more just, you know, kind of interest. And then being in college, the university I was in, East London, was a very kind of left-wing institution. But it was also primarily people who weren't born in England. So large Asian community, large African community, large Irish and Scots community. And a lot of the teachers had been political activists in other countries and in other conflicts. So we'd had, you know, kind of black students from South Africa who had fled apartheid and become academics in England, and people from other parts of the world. So all of those kind of mixes, I suppose, just pushed me in.
Okay, so like, I mean, so you said then you moved to Belfast and you worked for the party. You were a councillor up there. And I remember actually one of the first times I met you after you moved to Belfast. I met you at Christopher's funeral, and like, you know, we were talking, and at that stage you were a councillor for the area, and you were I suppose involved in what was going on with the Holy Cross School.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, when I moved to Belfast, a lot of Dublin people thought, oh God, you'll have a hard time up there. Jimmy, people won't be very welcome, and I have a Dubliner and somebody who wasn't born there. Or I found the very opposite. Generally speaking, and it's probably why I still like Belfast more than I like Dublin as a place, people are very straight. And I don't mean that in a sexual orientation sense. I mean, people are just really blunt, and they kind of tell you what they think, for good, bad, or indifferent. And if you are straight back with folks, if you work hard, if you do stuff, people respond very well. So I moved there in 95. I started working on Full Block Republican News as a journalist. I did that for a while. I was the national organiser for Sinn Féin Youth for a while. I worked in the party's press office during the peace negotiations. And then in 2001 was elected to Belfast City Council. The constituency was the Old Park electoral area, North Belfast. So it's the constituency which was the most sectarianised, the most divided. It had seen the largest number of conflict-related deaths across the community divide during the conflict. It's the section of the city that has the most interface walls, and still is the case. And during the period I was there, even though there were ceasefires, there was very, very significant levels of UDA violence, pipe bombing campaigns. And you had the loyalist blockade of Holy Cross primary Catholic school as well. So
I mean, that's quite an immersion though, like for someone with your background. You know, like, I mean, you talked earlier on, like, you know, that you come from a fairly privileged area of Dublin to begin with. You know, you went to really good schools. You were radicalized in London, so you had that left leaning. So, but you're there, like, you're suddenly like facing like the kind of sectarian like bile and sectarian kind of like being like, I suppose, hatred on both sides, you know, for the first time.
Yeah, although sometimes you can be a little bit too kind of simplistic about it. So what I found about Belfast, first of all, was it's much more complicated than that in terms of how people interact. So Holy Cross, the crude image of Holy Cross, which is a huge group of loyalist thugs trying to physically prevent primary school girl children and their parents from taking them to and from school every day, you know, and pipe bombing the parents and pipe bombing the RUC at the time. Okay, that fits that. But at the same time, there was huge amounts of dialogue behind the scenes, dialogue with Protestant clergy, dialogue with Protestant and Unionist community organisations, attempts to try and resolve not just that problem, but many of the difficulties. When I was on the council, for example, you know, the council funds community organisations, we would have lots and lots of community organisations from this very same loyalist communities that were supporting the Holy Cross blockade coming to us and lobbying us for funding. Now, when they would come to us, they would ask us not to tell their elected representatives that they were coming and talking to us in case it damaged their relationship with them. But it's more complex than I think it often looks from the outside. Yeah. But yeah, it was... When you're in the middle of it, you don't think it's particularly tough. And again, okay, I was there in that kind of 95 to 2006 period. But I was working with and living with people who were there in the 70s and 80s. You know, lots of families who had lost loved ones. Lots of families who themselves were survivors of acts of violence or imprisonment. So, you know, from the comfort of the fire here in Dingle, Holy Cross seems pretty horrific. But when you're there and you're thinking about, well, these people lived through, you know, stuff much more difficult than that, that kind of put it in perspective too. So it didn't seem, I suppose, as tough as probably what it looks like from the outside.
Okay. What impressed you, I mean, working full-time with Sinn Féin at that stage in Belfast, what impressed you about the organisation then?
I'm not so sure if anything impressed me about the organisation at that stage.
Like, I mean, what do you mean by that? I mean, like, you mean, you know, do you mean that their agenda was slightly different than what you expected, or was it
absolutely not. I was always very comfortable in the party. Political parties are voluntary organisations, and in our organisation, almost everybody is voluntary. So even though we work full time, you didn't get paid a salary. So
it's like being a musician.
Yeah, you work. Yeah, a little less melodic maybe, but. So you work part-time jobs at night, or if you were able to claim social welfare, you did that, or whatever you did. I mean, a lot of the people that I worked with had partners. So one or other of the partner would have been a full-time activist, and the other would have worked to support the family. That would have been quite common. I worked in a cafe in the university area with a chef from Ardoyne, which is obviously, for people who don't know, a strong nationalist area, and a junior chef from a really tough loyalist area called Tocmone. He had UDA tattoos all over. Of course, the great irony was Tocmone is Irish for Turf Lodge, and the staunch loyalist was from the staunch loyalist area, which was named Oscailge, which was always a thing we would remind him of when he was annoying us at stages.
So it must be some very interesting discussions at the past then in that kitchen.
What impressed me was a couple of things. And again, it's one of the things I found difficult moving back to Dublin was politics was really serious. And I don't mean serious in the sense of dull. Politics was life or death. And that was very much how everybody in politics saw it. So, for example, I was a councillor for 4 years. We all had loyalist paramilitary death threats on us multiple at times during that period of time, particularly Holy Cross. We spent a lot of time at interfaces after pipe bombings where there would be shootings taking place. Now, I don't want to dramatise it because, again, it sounds maybe worse than it was. But because it was kind of life or death, people were there because they believed in the politics. They weren't there for careers or self-advancement or any of that. And that gave it a particular character. And again, I was working with people, some of whom had spent 10 or 20 years in prison. Some of the councillors, some of the Sinn Féin colleagues had lost members of the family, Bobby Lavery and Danny Lavery, who were two Sinn Féin councillors. Bobby's son, a young teenage boy, was shot dead in a loyalist paramilitary attack on their house because they were trying to kill Bobby because he was a Sinn Féin councillor. So when you're working with people whose commitment to their ideals is that at that kind of level, I think that's the thing that really impresses you. And also, the party was pretty chaotic. We were small, we were disorganised, we were poorly funded. A lot of the time we were doing it on a wing and a prayer. But what kept you committed to it was actually not just the political ideals, but I think the quality or the calibre of the people you were working with. Which you would have to be there and be with those people to really get that, I suppose.
All right. So you came back to Dublin then. Did you come back to Dublin for a job or did you come back to Dublin for a family?
Neither. I was working full-time for the party from 95 pretty much through to the present. The 11 years in Belfast were very intense. And 11 years of full-time activism is quite a lot. And full-time activism doesn't just mean it's 9 to 5, you know, 5 days a week. It's 70, 80, 90 hours a week. And I think I kind of just got a little bit burnt out. Things were progressing very well in the peace process. The party's kind of political orientation was focusing more on the south. I think I just wanted a bit of a change. So I came back to Dublin, took a couple of years out of full-time activism, worked for a homeless NGO, and then threw myself back into it.
Okay, so you threw yourself back into it then. I mean, what year did you throw yourself back into it?
Well, I came back to Dublin in 2006. And again, I would have been working for the party on a voluntary basis during that time. I stood two elections and came last in both of, in 2007 and 2009. And then 2010, I started working, 2011, full-time for the party again.
Okay, so that 2011, after, was that the 2011 election that you had? That was the last election, so the number of representatives you had, the Dáil, had increased.
Yeah.
So the party was kind of, that's been the kind of height the party's been at. I'm curious about, like, your position within the party, because, I mean, you're very much coming from a kind of, like, a left-wing orientation, like, being quite so, like, you've got socialist leanings. You've been, when you're writing on Foblock and you're writing Sunday Business Post, you're coming from that particular aspect. Then Sinn Féin, to many people, strikes them as the party where there just seems to be a couple of different agendas. Obviously, you've got the agenda from the north and from what you talk about, what you say is a conflict. Then you've got, like, I mean, obviously, there's TDs and representatives who would like to be in power at all costs and for it to get into bed with whoever it is. But just looking at some of the kind of, like, I mean, comments, what's coming out. Then you've got you and, like, I mean, what you represent. You know, do you find it hard sometimes to have common bedfellows within the party? I mean, or where do you think you're seen? How do you think you're seen in the party?
Well, first of all, a lot of what you said, I don't recognise as being in the party that I'm in.
I'm just saying,
from the outside. No, I accept that, and it's not a new opinion for me to hear. First of all, I see myself as in the mainstream of the party, so I don't see myself as some unusual figure or kind of peripheral in any way. And also, see, there is whatever people on the outside think or see. For those of us on the inside of the party, we see ourselves as having a coherent ideology, and not just us, but left-wing Republicans historically. And there are different parts of that ideology, different parts of that political project, but they're not, you know, this group of people over here subscribe to that bit and these people over here subscribe to this other bit. And broadly, it's a left Republican agenda. I mean, if you really read on Foblock from 69 right through to the present, it talks about Sinn Féin as a left Republican or a democratic socialist Republican or a socialist Republican party. The party's constitution, which sets out the objectives, a democratic socialist republic is the ultimate objective of the party. Clearly, when the conflict was taking place in the north, that absorbed the overwhelming majority of the energy of activists in the party. Likewise with the peace process, your kind of negotiations and working through the peace process, likewise. And I think maybe what's happened for some people outside the party is now that we're in a kind of a post-conflict political period, north and south, people are getting an opportunity to see more of what Sinn Féin represents. So it's not that somehow we've added this bit on now. Mm. We were talking about healthcare, housing, education, unemployment, tax reform, not only as long as I've been in the party, but in the 70s and 80s. And the party always saw itself as a kind of left Republican or left of centre party during that period. Also, there is nobody I know in the party who wants to be in power at any cost. But if you're in a political party, you want to be in government. I mean, I want to be in government in terms of the party. The issue is on what terms, to do what and with who. And in fact, I think the more senior people in the party are actually the most cautious about all of those issues, partly because they've been around long enough and they've seen what happens to Labour or, you know, Clan the Public or whoever else when they went in as weaker parties.
Mm.
But no, we see ourselves as having a coherent ideology. The big challenge, I think, for any party on the left is, if you want to be in government, the real question is, so how are you going to achieve the things you want? What is your policy roadmaps or your practical proposals?
Yeah. Before all that happens, though, you have to be in government in the first place. So, I mean, over the last couple of weeks, I find that narrative in political journalism about, like, I mean, you know, who you're going to get into bed with after the next general election to be, like, being really, really confusing in many ways, because the general election hasn't been held yet, you know. But obviously, you know, there are kind of like conversations within parties. There are kind of like, I mean, subtle approaches and kind of like subtle kind of like channels, let's say, being kind of maintained. From your own point of view, obviously, you given your background and given your leanings, you would obviously kind of favour more kind of like a left socialist alliance. Do you think that's possible, or do you think it would be easier after an election to do business with, like, I mean, one of the bigger parties?
So there's a bunch of questions in there, and none of them are that straightforward. I mean, it's not just journalists who want to know who you're going to government with. Voters want to know. So I'm a constituency politician. I spend a huge amount of time in the constituency, and people ask that question too. So actually, it's not just a Leinster House or media bubble question. And people are particularly interested in asking smaller or emerging parties that question, because that has a lot to say about whether you can actually achieve the broader objectives you say you're standing in the election for. Because if you, on the one hand, are espousing a programme of very profound social, economic and political change, well, you can't achieve that if you're in government that's led by Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. And we know that. That's pretty obvious to anybody who studies contemporary politics or history. So in some senses, for some period of time, people in Sinn Féin were saying, look, let's fight an election on the base of our own manifesto, and then we'll see what happens afterwards. You know, we'll see what the electoral lay of the land is and who has what and what's possible. In the last general election in 2011, we chose not to do that for the first time in a while, and we set out a very clear stall where we said prior to the election, we would not, under any circumstances, participate in a government that was led by Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, because it would be a centre-right government.
Yeah.
And you couldn't achieve even a small portion of your policies. That's exactly the position we have now. And notwithstanding some journalists' attempts to unpick that by asking the same question over and over again, the position is really, really clear in terms of the mandated position from the parties Ardèche. We will not support a centre-right government led by Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. So what does that mean? Well, Fine Gael are somewhere around 25 to 30% if you average out the polls. Fianna Fáil is somewhere on 17 to 20% averaged out the polls. And Sinn Féin is somewhere on 15 to 18%, right? So that's the kind of the state of the parties. But there's about 30% of people who have yet to really make up their mind. 15% clearly undecided, and another 15% moving around. Those people won't decide, in my view, until the general election is called. They're going to wait to see, look at what's been offered, and probably will only decide in the last week or two of the election. So what does that mean? Well, Sinn Féin is not going to be the largest party on the other side of the election on the basis of all the information we have in front of us. Could we become the second largest party in votes or seats? That's a possibility. It's a very tough possibility to achieve, but even the numbers say it is a possibility. So if we came a hair's breadth ahead of Fianna Fáil, if we had just a few seats or just a few votes more, then we're in a serious position to say, OK, do we want to try and form a government with people who can sign up to similar proposals? Now, you'll know there's the Right to Change policy agenda out there that's been led by the five leading anti-water charge trade unions. Sinn Féin is endorsing that as a broad kind of policy consensus. But we would then talk to anybody, and that includes Fianna Fáil. Would they sign up to the kind of things that we as the larger party in government would be looking to implement? I doubt it sincerely. But it doesn't mean we wouldn't have the conversation with them and see. But I suppose the really big question is, I'm just
thinking, like, Owen, if you were asked this question on the doorstep and you give them that kind of answer, you're going to be on a lot of fucking doorsteps. You know, it's almost like you know, it's you know what I mean? Saying it's like you're nuancing it all out here. So it's like I'm kind of curious. So, like, I mean, from your point of view, as far as the party are concerned, they will not be in a government with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael next time around.
We will not support or participate in a government led by Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael.
Okay, so you'll be open to the situation of being in a government with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael. I'm not going to do a Declan on the braid on here. You'd be open to being in a government with Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael if you were the bigger party.
It would be more than if we were the bigger party, because that's not enough. Because being the bigger party doesn't mean anything. It's what the programme for government is. And in some senses, see, I think the coalition, in terms of the who bit of the coalition debate, is important. But the voters also want to know the what. So what are you going to do? What's the point of being in government? So what are you going to do about tax reform? What are you going to do about health reform, education, childcare, reform of the water system? So the real issue is, if you're the larger party, you're in better position to try and shape how your government is going to do those things. We know this. Every government, since we've had coalition governments since the 1940s, has been led by the larger party. So if you're the larger party, if you're then in a position through negotiations with other players to shape that agenda, then we would talk to anybody. What's the preference? The preference is to have the largest block of progressive, left, anti-austerity TDs in that government. And that means you're talking about more than Sinn Féin, because you have, you know, Anti-Austerity Alliance, you have People Before Profit, you have the Social Democrats, you have good progressive independents. Could you form a block with them first? Or with some of those people first? And then you could maybe negotiate with somebody else.
Well, that's a lot
of ifs, obviously. But
absolutely. But I find the idea of kind of like, I mean, a government consisting of all those different little blocks on the left just frightening. Not from any kind of ideological ground or not from any personalities, but just keeping that amount of people happy, you know?
And yet, interestingly, the first multi-party government we had in 1948 with the two Labour parties, Fine Gael, Clan na Publacta, Clan na Talava, and the Farmers' Party, made some of the most important progressive changes that we saw in social and economic policy at that period in time, partly because you had a left Republican Party in their Clan na Publacta. And it was as stable or instable as any of its comparative governments afterwards. I don't think you're going to have a government involving all of those parties. And also, look, I'm realistic enough to know if the election was to fall the way the polls have it, we're really looking at the frightening prospect of a government that involves Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael at the one time, with all of the difficulties that would have for people.
Yeah, I can't see that happening at all. But I'm going back to the doorstep in Dublin Midwest. Are there preferences being expressed by voters to you, as in, we don't want to see Fine Gael back in government, we don't want to see Fianna Fáil back in government, we don't want to see Joe Higgins in government?
Keep in mind, every time a politician tells you what they're hearing on the doors, they're telling you what they're hearing on the doors, they're knocking.
Yeah, they're telling you what they're hearing on the doors that they want to hear.
Well, or even the ones there, because keep in mind, your constituency is huge. You don't knock all the doors. No political party does. And we probably do more canvassing than any of the other parties in our constituency.
Bertie Ahern knocked on my door once.
And in some senses, Bertie Ahern was, particularly for Fianna Fáil, the end of that generation of politicians who did that kind of thing. But even he was exceptional. Like, Fianna Fáil organisation didn't do that elsewhere in the country at that time. But the first thing is this, what are the voters I'm talking to saying? And keep in mind, in the constituency I was elected to, Sinn Féin has 37% of the vote. So in Clondalkin, and that's both a large working class and lower middle class area, the party is very strong. But also Lucan is the other part of my constituency, and we have 13-14% of the vote, and we're knocking a lot more doors now there than we would have done traditionally. What people are saying is they are fed up of the type of governments they have had up until this point. They're fed up with political parties promising before they go into power and breaking all those promises after power. They would much prefer politicians to be upfront and honest in terms of what's achievable. So rather than saying you can have motherhood and apple pie today, they would prefer to hear people say, look, our health system, it's going to take us 10 years or more to reform it. And here are the steps that we'll take. And some of that's going to require some extra tax revenue, by the way. And here's where we think people should generate that tax revenue from. People are saying that's what they want to hear. Then you get into the conversation about, well, what kind of taxes? Who's going to pay them? What kind of services? Who's going to deliver them? And at that point, people start making their preferences. I get a genuine appetite out there, not an apathy towards politics, an apathy towards the traditional way in which politics was done in this state, and a real hunger for something different. And that's why Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who used to get 80% of the vote in this state combined, even up until 92, they were getting 72-73%. They're now down to 50%. And while the numbers might not look positive for a progressive-led or progressive-majority government at this general election, the broader trend is dramatic. The days where we were dominated by centre-right parties with 80% of the vote are over. And the possibilities of some new, different, and in my view, more progressive kind of realignment of Southern Irish politics emerging is there. Will it come in this election or between this election and the election afterwards? We don't know yet. But I think those of us that believe in that realignment, that want to see an end to rotating centre-right-led governments, this is quite an exciting time.
Totally. And it's also an exciting time for people who want to, I suppose, influence and lobby in any incoming governments. I mean, if we're looking at that kind of progressive new thinking, led by someone like Sinn Féin, are you receiving calls at the moment from having coffees, meeting people? Are there obviously there's an awful lot more interest being put in your kind of business policies as well? I mean, is that something that has been noticeable from the kind of strategy policies?
No, it doesn't increase during the election. You get more emails about the manifesto, but that's a more formal thing. No, we've been trying since the Oireachtas team increased size in 2011. We have a bigger team. I worked as part of that team as an advisor to Piers Doherty for 2.5 of those years. One of the objectives we set the party is for the first time we had a TD for every portfolio, which we'd never had with the smaller teams. And one of the things those TDs and their staffers were told is you now need to go out and engage with all of the stakeholders in that area. So when I was in finance, we would have met all the business organisations, all the social justice organisations, the trade unions, community-based organisations, a lot of academics. And that's, I suppose, if you're doing your job right as a TD in a TD's office, that's part of your function, to be part of that conversation about your portfolio area. We probably do a lot more of that than the other parties, is my suspicion. Most of the real lobbying, and this is the stuff that nobody gets to see and isn't recorded anywhere, doesn't happen with the political parties. It happens with ministers and senior civil servants in and around legislation before legislation is even published, which is a separate issue. But for the political parties, it's more about that conversation around those kinds of issues. So, for example, we launched just on Friday a comprehensive housing policy. So it's a 10-year housing, 15-year in some aspects of it, housing policy in terms of the complete restructuring of our private rental, social and private for purchase housing system. Trying to kind of look at the fundamental dysfunctionality of that system and say, okay, if you're serious about trying to create a much more stable system where people who want to buy can buy, people who want to rent long-term can rent and have security, people who are unable to have their housing needs met through the market can do so through a good social housing system, here's what it would look like, here's how much it would cost, and here's how we would get the money. And I think, again, that's, I think, one of the reasons why the more of that type of stuff Sinn Féin does, the more the voters respond, which is why we're, again, doing pretty well in the polls.
OK, so back to the doorstep then. I mean, do voters kind of like me and question you about Hugh McConville, Gerry Adams' membership of the IRA Army Council, telling you what to do every single day? The Army Council, by the way, contacted me earlier on. Certain questions I can't ask.
They had to vet you, obviously. Yes.
I have
the Army Council's instructions. This is, this is what they asked me to say. Just in case anybody wants to see it there. That's my script for the day.
But joking aside, does, like, you know, I get the feeling that it doesn't come up anymore because the people who would raise these issues as something that they would, as a reason for not voting Sinn Féin, are either dying or not being active, and there's more people right now who look at kind of Sinn Féin's, I suppose, policies, social policies, the housing policy, talking about the health policies. But I'm still curious. I mean, when something like Jim McConville happens, when something like Gerry Adams' latest denial of being a member of the IRA comes up, do you kind of get that?
It doesn't, in certain senses. So, I mean, keep in mind, again, I'm in a constituency that has a very large Sinn Féin vote.
This is Dublin Midwest.
Dublin Midwest, and particularly the Clondalkin end of it. We're the largest party in the constituency. We have more councillors than anybody else. Touch wood, we hopefully will get a general election seat when the general election is coming up. So people know who we are. People have met me. People have met the other members of the Sinn Féin team. People see us all of the time. So when people are judging Sinn Féin and Dublin Midwest, yes, they're judging in terms of Mary Lou and Gerry and Pearce and Pádraig and Patter in terms of their interaction at leaders' questions and that, but they know who we are. So the kinds of questions I get asked all of the time are questions about what am I going to do and what are we going to do, both locally and in terms of the broader statewide legislative agenda. I'd be lying if I said nobody ever mentioned, for example, the conflict in the north and Sinn Féin's role in and support for armed struggle during the conflict. That's just, clearly people do raise that. But they don't necessarily raise it in the way you think. So, you know, sure, I canvassed a Green Party member who I didn't realise was a Green Party member in the last general election. And of course, he said to me on the door, you know, well, I like some of your policies. I'm a pacifist and completely opposed to violence. I don't think what you did over the last 30 years in the conflict was right. And you will never get my vote. OK, but I was never going to get his vote anyway. But the last house I canvassed in the 2011 election, which was in a kind of a lower middle class housing estate in Clondalkin Village. So not a typical area for Sinn Féin. And where, on the poll numbers, we should only be getting about 4 or 5%. But where in that election, actually, we got about 20%. The very last door I canvassed was a guy who works in the private sector. His wife is a part-time SNA, involved in the local GA club, probably was a floating kind of Fianna Fáil Labour voter most of his life. And Pádraig McLoughlin had been on Vincent Brown the evening before, and there was a big controversy because Pádraig McLoughlin made remarks around the two RUC officers who were shot dead by the IRA in Lurgan in 1997, so just before the reinstatement of the ceasefire. And we called at the door. And the guy was saying, oh, and you know, I was really disappointed with Pádraig last night. Okay, so we had a conversation. We had this long conversation. He thought the party wasn't saying the right thing, that we needed to be much more humble about responding to those kind of requests. And at the end of the conversation, he says, but Owen, I've already made up my mind, I'm voting for Sinn Féin. So people can disagree with the role that Sinn Féin played or the role that former IRA volunteers played during the 30 years of conflict and still vote for the party. So that conversation isn't necessarily a barrier. And in some senses, like what was really interesting about the Martin McGuinness presidential bid was that for the first time, certainly in my lifetime, there was a real statewide conversation in the 26 counties about the conflict and about people's role in the conflict, not on a single TV show or not about a single incident. Everywhere people were talking about it. One of the reasons why we decided to stand Martin McGuinness as a candidate in the election, not because we thought he would get elected, we want the South to talk about the 30 years of conflict, just like that conversation is continuing in the North. Because if you want to learn the lessons from the Civil War, where there was never a conversation after the ending of the Civil War in this state in the 1920s, unless we have a serious, structured conversation around conflict, about violence, about perpetrators of violence, victims and survivors of violence, in a way that is kind of healing of the society, things aren't going to change. So in some senses, we're the people who want the conversation. And when I sit down and say to somebody, okay, but let's have that conversation properly, a lot of the people who you read in the Sunday Independent who are talking about these things, they're not really interested in the conversation about conflict resolution, truth recovery, and really understanding what happened and who did what to who and why.
Because that's very complicated.
It's much more about politicising. It's not that it's more complicated. It's because their interest isn't actually the truth of what happened in the conflict. It's about using individual instances as political sticks in the contemporary political battlefield, which is fine. But there's more important things to be done with that information than just fighting the current election.
Do you have problems with what the IRA did during the Troubles?
Huge problems with large aspects of it. And again, like, I'm very open with people. I'm not a pacifist. I believe there are circumstances in political history where violence is necessary. It would be preferable if it wasn't. If there are non-violent mechanisms to achieve what you want available, violence is never justified. But history tells us, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's in our own history here, we're about to celebrate and commemorate in 3 months' time a very significant period of violence in our own history. Violence is there and it is part of our political lives. That doesn't mean you should revel in it. It doesn't mean you should promote it. It means in the first instance you should try and avoid it. But I find very few people, when you really talk to them, can really defend a completely pacifist position at all times. Do I think the killing of civilians is right? No, I don't. I think it's wrong. Do I think everything that the IRA was involved in, either in the most recent period of conflict or indeed back in the Civil War, the War of Independence in 1916, was right? No, I don't. But nor am I going to say that these people are criminals and this was terrorism, because, you know, President of Ireland laid a wreath at the grave of O'Donovan Rossa. I mean, I'm sure people here saw the commemoration of O'Donovan Rossa and watched it and maybe played some kind of part in it. What was O'Donovan Rossa's contribution to Irish republicanism? In fact, what was his contribution to revolutionary struggle anywhere in the world? O'Donovan Rossa invented, not just in Ireland, globally, invented the idea of urban terrorism. He invented the idea that you didn't face off your army of greater numerical strength on the battlefield, but you engaged in that kind of military tactics. And yet, the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, the great and the good of Irish society, including the editors of all the political papers that attacked Sinn Féin all the time, they all lined up and paid homage to O'Donovan Rossa, knowing full well what he did. So, my point isn't to trivialise violence. For me, one of the really good things about the period of time I've been in Sinn Féin is that a huge part of our work has been about trying to help bring about an end to violence. And I'm very proud of the very small part I might have played in some of that locally in North Belfast. But at the same time, we also need to be honest about violence in our society today and in the past. And for me, rather than condemning that violence, I think what we need to do is say, okay, that period of our conflictive history is over. But we need to heal all of the divisions from that conflict, including divisions and hurt and pain and suffering that people like me or people who I support inflicted on others. But you can only do that through dialogue, through reconciliation, through truth recovery, not from some of the bizarre kind of politics that we see. Again, the Sunday Independent is probably the worst example.
You don't like Sunday Independent, do you?
I don't think they like me is probably a bigger issue.
No, but I'm curious about that, because, I mean, you know, you write a column for the Sunday Business Post, you know, and the columns are always really interesting when you go after other newspapers. All newspapers columns, no newspaper columnists who go after other columns, it's always interesting to read them, you know. Like, I'm kind of curious about, like, I mean, that narrative that's built up around Sinn Féin. It seems to me that a lot of the kind of, like, say, Sunday Independent, that stream of press, just seem to be kind of, like, worried about this kind of, this Sinn Féin growth. There seems to be, like, I mean, certain kind of, a certain swathes of community who are really kind of, they don't understand, like, I mean, why this support's coming from. They don't know how to kind of relate to it. But at the same time, I mean, it strikes me there's also kind of like an excitement there as well. There are certain kind of parts of the community as well who want to engage with Sinn Féin and want to kind of, like, I mean, work with them, because they recognise that sometime in the future, maybe not next general election, sometime it may well be that you may be the leader of kind of like Sinn Féin. Your partner may be the leader of Sinn Féin. It's not going to happen under...
You might be the leader of Sinn Féin.
Trust me on that. The Army Council already told me I won't be. I'm curious about that.
They change their mind sometimes.
That's okay. I'll keep that in mind. But I'm curious about, like, you know, do you see yourself, like, are you looking at kind of new recruits into the party, newcomers into the party? Are they coming in with different ideas, you know? And is this what kind of, like, scares the establishment a little bit? Because suddenly Sinn Féin is on the up and, like, they don't know how to manage this.
Well, I'm actually one of the people in Sinn Féin who complains less about the press. Partly because, and I very rarely write about the press, partly because that's what they do. Like, why waste your time? If you get a column in a Sunday newspaper, which is a pretty tough thing for a politician to get, why waste your time giving out or whinging about the Sunday Independent when you can promote or talk positively or engage with other stuff? And even the Army Council article I wrote wasn't a reply to any newspaper as such. It was more just about the politics of it generally. So I think the media does what it does. I have lots of views on it, but I don't necessarily spend lots and lots of my energy or time moaning on about them. But the Sunday Independent and the Irish Independent, historically, so from, you know, 1916, and in fact I was reading a biography of Jim Larkin today, so from the very start of the 20th century, have always been the paper of the establishment, particularly the political and the economic establishment, from William Martin Murphy through to Tony O'Reilly or to Dennis O'Brien. I mean, the continuity is there. So anybody who is seen, either individuals or political parties, to threaten or challenge or undermine the grip that that political and economic establishment has in our society is of course going to be attacked by them. So when the Sunday Independent attacks me, do I get up and go, oh God, this is really terrible, what am I going to do? No, it means I'm doing my job right. If I'm not getting attacked, or if Sinn Féin isn't getting attacked by the Independent and the Herald and even sometimes by your fine newspaper, we're not doing what we should be doing, because 60% of Southern Irish society don't benefit either from the political views that dominate those parties or the economic interests that those papers espouse. And those people do not take their voting intentions from the Independent or the Irish Times. I know that really hurts the people who invest so much time in those newspapers. They take their voting intentions from their day-to-day lives, what's going on with their jobs, whether they have money in their pockets or not, whether they can pay their mortgages or not, whether they have a family member lying on a trolley in the hospital A&E ward, or they have a daughter who's homeless and can't even get into emergency accommodation because of the housing crisis, and the daughter happens to have a job and still can't afford to live in the private rental sector. So people are much more sophisticated, which is why political parties can grow despite the INMs and the Irish Times of this world. And do I think the INM group is nervous about the rise of Sinn Féin? I think they are. I think they're more nervous about their declining sales, and they think this very kind of populist anti-Sinn Féin, kind of Paul Williams, kind of, you know, sensationalist crime agenda will sell their newspapers, although recent figures don't seem to suggest that's the case. But yeah, I think they're nervous about us, and I think the reason they're nervous about it is because they know we're not the same as Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael or Labour, and they're really scared about a situation where we might actually have access to some of the levers of power and may just be able to do some of the things we've been talking about for the last 10 or 15 years, because the people who they represent are the people who will be hurt by that.
Okay, so like, I mean, Sinn Féin are definitely not like Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Labour, and like that also kind of it goes go back to what you were saying earlier on about like, I mean, a Sinn Féin in government and where it would come from. And I mean, going back to kind of like, I suppose again your original left wing leanings, and there's a quote you had from the Business Post column, which is like, historically the Irish left has suffered from two weaknesses: a poverty of ambition and a lack of credible alternatives. And I'm curious about like, I mean, your views on kind of the left's total inability in Ireland, total inability to rise above constant infighting, permanent, like this whole adherence to permanent revolution, and just that sort of like split. I mean, do you think, you know, that basically, like in many ways, that left wing kind of alphabet soup look upon someone like Sinn Féin with as much horror as the independent group? Because, I mean, you've kind of shown that it is possible to put together a coherent, maybe kind of sometimes people could say it as almost like Stalin's party in many ways. But, like, I mean, the fact is, you can kind of show that you can actually put a left wing agenda forward.
I mean, for me, the first thing the Irish left broadly defined, and in fact, even though I don't think Joan Burton or Alan Kelly are left, there are lots of left activists in the Labour Party. I work with them in Settlement County Council. I engage with them in the constituency all the time. So maybe I'm a little bit unusual in this at the moment, but I don't write the Labour Party off completely. I think the current leadership of the Labour Party have decided what direction they're going, but the party and the constituency they represent, I actually think people like me need to be dragging them back in a more progressive direction. But the first problem of the Irish left historically is to stop blaming other people for our failures. So we've blamed the Catholic Church for too long. We've blamed treacherous leaders for too long. We've blamed everybody else but ourselves. If your political project isn't growing, if it is not convincing more and more people in communities to support you, that's primarily your fault. because it means you're not doing your thing right, whatever it is that you're doing. And I think until the Irish left generally starts to accept that and then say, okay, so what is it that we're doing wrong and how do we rectify those things to grow our political project, we're going to be stuck in that cycle. I think in fairness to Sinn Féin, that's a conversation we've been having for about 15 years, and one of the reasons why we're beginning to do much better is because we've learned some of those mistakes. We'll probably make more of them in the future and we need to learn from those. The key things are, first of all, you need to build a political organisation that is truly national, that is in every parish, that is in every community, that is in every town, that is in every city. And that takes time and effort. And a lot of political parties don't have that ability. So, you know, Fianna Fáil didn't become the most dominant political party in the history of the state overnight. It took them 15 years of hard graft before they were even in a position where they could win an election. So the first thing is that's a big bit of it, which I think a lot of the correspondents miss. The second thing is, you see, the left talks to itself too much and talks to itself in outdated theoretical language and outdated kind of, you know, theoretical discourses, which are very interesting when we're doing it ourselves. Ordinary people don't think and talk like that. And therefore, if you want a credible project, it has to be spoken in a language that is clear and accessible to people. But crucially, it has to be able to answer the question, not where do you want to go? Everybody wants a more equal society, or almost everybody. Michael McDougall maybe is the exception, and some of his supporters. The real question is, how do you get from this deeply unequal, two-tier, and politically corrupt state to there? That's the bit that the left has never got right, not just here, but in certainly most of the European countries. How do you set out a roadmap? But also, how are you honest with people? One of the big problems with Irish political parties is they want loads more public services, but they're not willing to say where the tax revenue is going to come from. So,
Where does tax revenue come from in your world?
So, the biggest problem. So, if you take all of those areas where people are concerned about, the housing crisis, the health crisis, the absence of childcare, and the absence of school places, and the gross inequalities within school attainment levels. One of the reasons why those things exist is because historically this state has chronically underinvested in the social and economic infrastructure, chronically, by all European indicators. And while we've caught up a little bit in some areas in more recent times, there's a huge deficit that's there. Now, there are also structural reforms that need to take place within those services. Our problem is we have a tax take similar to Lithuania, Latvia, Bulgaria and Romania. So if you want Bulgarian and Romanian style public services, fine, keep with the tax system we have. So how do you do it? The only way you can start to progressively increase towards the European average of tax and investment in social and economic recovery for everybody is if you start to say, okay, first of all, we go to those people who have the most and who can afford to pay a little bit more. And really, the proposals we're making are pretty modest. So we talk about a third band of income tax, asking people earning over 100,000 euros to give us an extra 7 cents on every euro they earn over the 100,000. That's a small but significant increase, 400 million. A wealth tax. And again, our proposal for wealth tax, and I wrote the legislation along with Pierce. Again, it's a very modest proposal. It's a 1% on net assets, taking away all your liabilities and debts, on income over a million, excluding a portion of the family home and working assets on farms and businesses. But Michael Noonan himself on the floor of the Dáil said that would raise us between 500 and 600 million. I think it's a little bit more, but you have to wait and see. So first of all, that's where you start. You don't hit the poorest in society by increasing VAT or slamming flat rate property charges, mortar charges. You ask those with a little bit more to pay a little bit more. You also close all of the loopholes around corporation tax. 12.5% would be great as a starting point if we could get everybody even to pay that, and particularly the big multinational corporations. Some progress has been made, but you need to do more. That will take you a third of the way to the EU average. And then what you need to start having is a conversation with citizens, with people who earn 50 grand, 60 grand, 70 grand, so people who aren't high earners by any estimation. If you want universal medical care, if you want to be able to access your GP on the basis of your medical need and not on the basis of whether you have the 50 euros in your pocket, you are going to have to make a larger social insurance contribution. If you want to have access to good quality, affordable childcare, you are going to have to make additional contributions elsewhere in the tax system. And I think a political party that does that and that sets that out year on year over a 5 to 10 year period, I think most people, even people who are still feeling very squeezed as we emerge officially out of the recession, will respond positively. And the more that's the conversation, not about, you know, Enda Kenny or Bertie Ahern, but what's your vision for society? do you want to continue with the failed two-tier social and economic mess that we've had for the last 30 years? Or do you want something that's different, but different in the basis of a credible plan? And I think that's the lesson for the left. If a left party or coalition of parties can offer that, I think rather than having a 50% of the voters floating around Sinn Féin, the Trotskyist parties and the independents, it'll start to coalesce around the party that offers that. And it's more than 50%, because what all of the studies tell us, all of the ESRI assessments of every budget, particularly since Fine Gael and Labour came in, 60% of the population have not felt the benefit of any of the last five budgets. And 60% of the population are not feeling any recovery in their pockets. Why? Because it's not a recovery designed for them. So I think, despite all the difficulties of the left, all the constant bickering, all of the self-imposed failures, there is a huge opportunity that's there. And I see it all the time. One of the reasons why Sinn Féin in our constituency has 25% overall of the vote, 37% in my own end of it, is because I think when you have that conversation with people on a weekly basis, in the local newspapers, on the doors, in the community groups, with the Chamber of Commerce or whoever, I think people are saying, that makes a lot of sense to us. Let's try that.
Mm. Can you see a day when someone like you is going to lead the party?
No, I certainly not someone like me. I think...
You don't think so?
No.
You think it's always going to be like me, coming from someone from the north?
No, I don't think so. I think the leader we have at the minute is very good. I like him a lot.
Do you follow him on Twitter?
I do, and I do cringe sometimes when he tweets. But
you do know that, like me, if you want to become a leader, you have to up your Twitter game.
What I like about Jerry's Twitter, even though it does sometimes make me cringe, particularly the tweet that he had today with him and Mark McGuinness in those bizarre fishing hats, but anyway, is that he does his own tweets. So love him or hate them, Jerry Adams isn't paying some PR company or some 90 grand a year civil servant to run his Twitter account. Jerry does it, and his quirky bit of his personality, which people don't normally get to see, you know, in the political stuff, comes out in that. So if I was his media advisor, I'd probably be beating him around the head half of the day because of some of the tweets. But I think they're pretty honest, and I think you get a sense of him as a person, which isn't a bad thing.
How long more do you think he's going to run? I mean, he's very healthy man. I mean, I was reminded when I was thinking about this question of Charlie Hoy's comment that, like, some of those Chinese leaders go into their 80s and 90s. You know, I mean, could we foresee this, or do you think a day will come when, like, Jerry and Martin McGuinness will step away from the stage?
I'll let you into a secret. The Army Council told me I could tell you the date on which Jerry is retiring. Look, the first thing is, actually, I think Jerry would have liked to retire a few years ago, personally. Like, he's given his entire life over and above what most political leaders on this island have given. Whether you agree with him or disagree with him, you have to acknowledge that. The problem is, the peace process in the north is still at a very sensitive point, and we're having difficulties. The party is doing really well in the south, and the last time, in fact, I don't remember the last time a political party whose party is doubling their support in the opinion polls was even asked the question about when they're going to resign, let alone seriously considered it. So there's lots of reasons why he shouldn't resign, and lots of reasons why people like me think he's the best person to lead the party now. He'll lead the party into the general election, I've no doubt about that. And I think, depending on the political context and what happens afterwards, I think, you know, at some point in the near future, the party will start to have that conversation. But I remind everybody of this, particularly some of your political correspondents in the Irish Times. I know you're not responsible for them.
I'm not. Jesus,
I'm going to hold you responsible today anyway.
Like, thanks, Bowen.
Really, when was the last time a political party rising in the polls, where everybody is saying, should this party be in government or not? When was the last time a political party anywhere in Europe in that position was being constantly asked when their leader, the person who has led the party to that point, is going to resign? It's not a question of his age. I don't care.
Fine Gael last time round.
That's because people didn't think he could win the election. But there's no question mark now. Enda Kenny is the second most successful leader Fine Gael have ever had after Gareth Fitzgerald, much and all as I dislike the politics of both men. So this idea that a political party which is rising in the polls, which is a serious contender for government, which just got in the north our largest real vote and percentage share vote ever, and possibly on the other side of the assembly elections next year might be the largest party. When was the last time anybody asked a leader in a comparable position, listen, lad, you know, you're doing really well here, but when are you thinking about going? Jerry is the leader of our party because we want him to be the leader. He is, without doubt, whether you like him or not, for those of us in the party, the most skilled, the most competent, and the most capable person to do all of the aspects of his job. That doesn't mean he does everything brilliantly. Pierce Doherty is a much better finance spokesperson. Mary Lou resonates with sectors of the electorate in a way that Jerry doesn't. So everybody has their strengths. But in the round, is he the best person to lead the team? Without question. And until a majority of us in the party think otherwise, he'll remain as the leader.
Okay. Eoghan Brin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a million to Eoghan for taking the time to come to Dingle to join us at Banter. This podcast was recorded by Andy Wilson, produced by Banter series producer Tanya White, and made with the help of Molly King and all the other voices. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. Check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.